This is Gemma Redgrave, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
This is Gallifrey Public Radio, a weekly podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of Doctor Who. We travel through classic and new episodes, explore the extended universe, and play a few games from time to time. We do discuss news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but we'll warn you before anything considered spoilers comes up.
Welcome to episode 437 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where everything sucks, the world's horrible, we just want to go hide in a closet. Wait a second, I'm a podcaster, I'm already literally in a closet. I'm Jay.
I'm Julie.
I'm Kier.
And I'm Haley. And this week, the Torchwood Children of Earth series hits the fourth day of five, and the brakes on the speeding train are completely cut.
We've avoided the hardest emotional hammer blows for three episodes thus far. But so many terrifying and alarming plot points have now been set in place that there's no choice but to start confronting them.
The first to hit home is the realization that the 456 deal is one that was based on a precedent that Jack himself helped establish in 1965, at the time trying to arrange for a cure for a potential catastrophic illness.
Yeah, the horrific moment arrives when we learn that those children taken back then have survived, never aging, and are in some sort of terrifying state of capture by the 456. And then we're hit with the fact that the British government, after a failed negotiation, have devised some sort of smokescreen strategy for getting the requested 10% of the world's children, and the selection of what that 10% is abhorrent as well, to be turned over to meet this demand.
And as Torchwood descends upon the 456 tank to threaten public exposure and certain global defiance, a demonstration of power takes out nearly every life in the building, including one of our heroes.
This is unacceptable.
We do not harm the children. They feel no pain.
Do not harm the children. They feel no pain. They live long beyond their years.
Well, that's okay then.
But we still don't know. What does it do with them? What does it want them for?
We knew we had held this at arm's length for about as long as we could, and we spoke during our day three discussion that this was like getting the chessboard in some of the final positions for the really, really damaging blows. And now they're starting to fall. But in doing so, they keep going back to remind us of the justification for why things have gotten to this point. You know, keep sending us back to 1965, keep reminding us that this was done as a result of, well, they've offered us this cure for this, how timely, we're talking about this as we're dealing with the global pandemic, right. Of this catastrophic illness, and that this is a token of good faith or something. We're constantly being reminded of this. It makes you feel horrible, but at the same time, I feel like something in the back of my mind keeps saying, well, how else would they respond? How else would they deal with this? What would be some of the other ways of approaching these sort of instances?
Yeah, no, this is absolutely a no-win scenario. There is no good option, and so it is just a matter of picking the lesser of the two evils. And unfortunately for those in charge, 12 lives is a lot better than hundreds of thousands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even at a promise of helping to save that, it seemed to be the right choice.
Right.
And to the aliens' benefit, to the 456 benefit, is that it was their way of sort of testing the population of Earth to say, will they do this? and then they come back mm-hmm. looking for more.
Right.
I feel like from a writer's perspective, the initial 12 was there specifically so that the vast majority of people will be like, I can understand. I don't like it, but I might be able to see myself making that same choice if I were pushed into that scenario. You know, 12 children is, in the grand scheme of like the global, you know, population is not a lot. You know, they took orphans, so they didn't have any family that was going to miss them, things like, they did all of these things to kind of stack it to where you feel horrible as hell agreeing with them, but you're like, I can see the point. And so when they come asking for the 10%, you're like, oh, it's like, we already went the initial step. Now it's like, how do you pull back from that?
Yeah. Well, and especially knowing like hundreds of thousands are going to die of this disease that they're offering a cure for, more than 12 children are going to die of that. So even if you're like, well, it's children versus not children, it's like, well, it's still way more kids would die from this. So it's easier to take that step. And then it's like, all right, how far can you push numbers and still justify
right.
it?
It's the ultimate worst case scenario of the trolley car decision.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
How many are worth the lives of everyone else? It's so simplified when you look at like one person or five people. Well, clearly you're going to do
there's,
that.
There's
but then,
one Shakespeare over here, and five Santas on that. No way.
Right. Yeah, we've seen that iterated out in other shows. Mm-hmm. But I think in this case, it is the... What hurts the most is that this is the second time around and the stakes are so much higher.
And they still have to deal with this gruesome rationalization for everything that they're doing. It feels like, in a way, a lot of instances, a lot of really key points across the first two seasons of Torchwood, as seen through Jack working with his team, he was sort of the representative token of the hard call, right? Having to be the one where I'm in a far greater position of knowledge beyond what everybody else here at the table realizes. So it's like a microcosm of what we're now dealing with, you know, where he has to say, you know, you have to understand there's these decisions that need to be made, which seems funny when he goes and actually cracks out the line about the harm to the one is the harm to all and that right. sort of statement. But again, this is the duplicity and the struggle that goes on within Jack throughout. He doesn't want to be put in this position, so he doesn't want to have to make these sort of decisions about, you know, what is it going to be acceptable collateral damage or however it's going to be discussed. Let's call them units and not children.
Yeah.
But it seems like when we've got the government, or I should say the parliamentary figures assembled around the table. And especially after the point where, like, the U.S. delegates, like, get up and walk out. They don't even want to be a part of it anymore. But they have that horrible, horrible conversation about deciding...
Well, that was just the U.K. delegation.
Right.
This was different than that world group.
Yes. Right. But I'm saying, but that's where it starts getting boiled down further and further and further. So now what we've been prepared for... As an audience, seeing Jack have to deal with his team saying, no, somebody's got to be the one to step up and make. And you think, well, it's a struggle, but it's a noble, horrible thing that you're doing, Jack, and we still love you and so forth. You don't have that compassion
right.
for these people saying things like, oh, well, what else do we have, you know, a school ranking system for in this nation? Yeah. Why do we bother evaluating failing and succeeding schools if not to figure out the failing ones that can just boom, get them out of the gene pool?
Before we even get to that discussion, there's like when they were going to send in the lowball offer, it's like, what people do we have available? It's like, oh, we've got these like refugee kids that are applying for asylum status. Nobody's going to miss them. We've got these kids in homes. Like, what number of kids in that category can we scrounge up? Like, that was a terrible discussion that primed you to hate these people.
Well,
I
mean, and Frobisher kind of goes and like, he's like, we've got, you know, and he's giving them everything he can. He's like, I've got 33, you know, failed asylum seekers right here. And the guy's just like, can we make it 60? Like, it's like, these are human lives you're talking about. And you're just like, it's like, oh, let's just, you know, raise the estimate a little bit. And the fact that Frobisher without like, I mean, just takes that slight pause and yeah, we can do that. Like, I don't know how, but we can do that.
Yeah, Frobisher definitely starts to descend rapidly mm-hmm. in this one, as far as becoming a matter of being caught in the wrong situation and having to be the representative of the worst possible decisions, and then starting to actually take lead on things and put forth some horrible decisions and horrible options himself.
But can you imagine, had they brought Torchwood in for reasonable discussions from the beginning, how different Jack's role could have been? Because now they know what the ask is, the demands made up front were handled poorly. Mm-hmm. Frobisher going in and saying, this is off the record, we're trying to CYA here instead of actually do a proper negotiation. The aliens know that they already have the upper hand.
Sure.
And I think part of Jack's role and part of what we've seen with him, with his team, to your what you were saying, is that he always takes that sort of blame me, let me be the bad messenger and make those hard decisions. One, because he's got the history of experience, because mm-hmm. he's however many, we don't even know how old at this point. But he also is the one to say he's going to live forever, and he's already stone hardened toward a lot of those decisions.
Oh, yeah.
And I think had they done a little bit of that earlier on and let him be involved, this, I'm not saying it would have, but it could have gone a totally different way. Mm-hmm. But now that it is the only option for them to kind of push their way in and be on the bottom edge of that, trying to force things back, mm-hmm. it's too late.
And it's funny if we look at it in hindsight and say, yeah, that would have been a valuable asset to have at the table for the decision-making process. But as soon as this all started to come to light, their first decision with regard to Torchwood was kill them, mm-hmm. get them off.
Which I think the right decision would have been never build the chamber.
Yeah.
Like never, nothing. Give them nothing.
Right.
Because as soon as you give them 1 ounce, they're in. They're in your building. They're doing all of this stuff. You don't even know if they're not the ones who would have been, or maybe did, release the virus all those years ago.
I think the implication clearly from this episode is that they did, because they have another virus that they release into that building.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But if the chamber doesn't get built, doesn't that just mean that basically you only have one-way communication?
Right.
Because they are communicating through the kids, but not very well. And we have no way of communicating with them. So they're still doing stuff. They still could release a virus even if we're not communicating with them. The tank just kind of gives a way to communicate.
If they release the virus at that point, though, there's been no demands made and there've been no inroads towards here's what we want. There is no way that they will get that. Something about this tells me, and I don't remember the ending, but it has to be willfully given. You have to gather the children for them to bright light take them away.
Right.
They can't just go in and grab selected people from around the entire globe. So if the UK government had admitted, yes, we've done this before, here's how things went poorly the last time. Mm-hmm. If you ignore those summons, if you try to do some of these other things by being honest, bringing Jack in and kind of laying all the cards on the table, you can then say like, nah, we did this. You said you'd never come back.
Mm-hmm. Did they build the tank last time? Is that what they had to do to communicate last time? Other means of communication then.
Well, they just had the incoming signal on the 456, which is what they were breaking down for Jack in the 1965 flashback at the start of this episode.
Yeah, and it had kind of said, like, this is where they told us to be. They said to bring this many children. They said they'd transmit this stuff. I don't know if there was back and forth communication or not.
Hmm. One of the things that I was having, that I was tumbling with a bit, aside from just the fact that I know that they were trying to make this a matter of, you know, well what would you do? You know, what kind of decisions could be made? And they were showing that at a bunch of different levels, you know, as far as what would you do in the situation 65? What would you do across the negotiation table here? Would you try to counteroffer or would you just try to... And then Frobisher coming forward with his strategy, this idea of being the dupes, the naive dupes rather than the willing or complicit accomplices, or however, I forget the exact phrasing, the way they went about it. But now he is coming up with the cover stories and working it, you know, as far as, you know, PR and that sort of thing to come up with these solutions. And then you start thinking, well, okay, yeah, if I'm going to do a big, you know, a government cover up thing, yeah, telling you know, 10% of the kids need to come in and get their jabs because we're going to protect them from. It's an elegant, horrible solution.
Yeah.
Isn't that what middle management is for?
Coming up with elegant, horrible solutions? Yes.
And I mean, if you don't believe that this is almost exactly how government would handle a situation like this, you're lying to yourself. Like, that's one of the things that this scene always sticks out in my mind, or this, the, you know, progression of scenes, as being like, this is exactly what would happen behind closed doors. This is exactly how it would play out, because that's, it is such real logic and emotion behind it. And like, you can see these politicians are like, you know, they're at each other's throat because they can't come up with the right solution. And then finally they hit on something that's like, everyone's like, wow, that could work. That's better than anything I can come up with. It's horrible, but yeah, let's go with it.
Right.
But it's also not the right answer.
No.
Because the right answer is having people in the room who would stand up for the correct representation to say that is not fair. That is completely an incorrect way to analyze who's worthy of any of this.
Everyone at that table, though, with the exception of maybe Lois Habiba, had already determined, as, by the way, Nick Briggs's character. Yeah. Hi, Nick Briggs. Haven't seen you on camera before. It's interesting. Have basically saying that that this is an unwinnable war. So do we go to war with an alien force that there's absolutely no way that we can win, or do we go to war with our own people to try to save them?
Yeah, and I'm not talking about the war. Okay. I'm talking about the, how do we choose that 10%, and are my kids and my closest family, how am I supposed to tell my brother that I let his children go?
Oh, sure,
go?
Yeah.
That's the discussion I'm talking about. Okay. You need to have representation in your government so that choices like that cannot be made.
Right.
So that discussion becomes a, why are you saying that about my constituents or whomever should have been counted as real and
absolutely
legitimate humans that should be cared for just because they come from lower income?
Nope, you were seeing class hierarchy at work.
Yeah, and there's no one at that table to defend anyone, and they all admit it, and they say, well, this is why we are government officials. Pat ourselves on the back. We just solved our problems, but no one else's.
Yeah, well, they refer to themselves as essential.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they refer to themselves as essential. They clear their own families and children. Mm-hmm. And then they go the one step further to say all of that horrible stuff that woman said.
Yeah.
Which is like, if this isn't random, then like, let's not be random about it. Let's be systematic about it. Mm-hmm. And like, let's take our standardized test scores that haven't been useful for anything ever and use those to sort our population.
Right. Because we're taking out the future prison inmates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is the worst.
Absolutely.
And I, to Jay's point, I understand why they wrote it that way, because we can all imagine that being the conversation that would be had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it is the reason why it shouldn't be.
The real thing, though, is like, it's, even though it is absolutely horrible, even though it is like the worst possible glimpse of humanity, you kind of look at it and it's like, it makes sense. It's twisted and wrong, but I can understand how they got there.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it all the much worse.
But only because they are off, like you're saying, the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
And it just shouldn't be that way.
Right.
Which is, I mean, I know we all are not okay with it and it's kind of standing up for it. But the fact that they wrote it into it, of course, is like, we're looking at this as the worst case scenario.
That's one of the reasons why I feel like this is such a good series, is because it is like, the vast majority of humanity is going to watch this and think, that's horrible. I kind of understand, but it's wrong. But it puts you in such a situation that you're like, I don't know what the right answer is. I know that one is wrong, but I can't come up with a good, elegant solution to this. And it is that kind of that moral quandary that you find yourself in.
It was a good reason to put our heroes on the outside of all of this from episode one, because what happens if they're in that room? If you force them to help come up with the decision, like, okay, you know, we tried to say no, we tried to offer less. Now we're at the point where we have to do the 10%. What do we do? How do we make that choice?
Right.
And I don't think we really want to see the characters that we love involved in that discussion, no matter what they end up saying.
Yeah, our protagonists can stay separate and quote unquote clean through all of this. Whereas if they were part of the discussion, anything short of absolutely not taints them moving forward.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is where it allows Jack to come in and be the hard stop no.
Right.
And but then everyone in the building dies.
I was going to say, but even then, that's not the right answer either.
No.
Right. Well, then it becomes a matter of, okay, if you have no way to be able to negotiate and you have to try to defy them, what is your, you know, what are your viable options to do that? And he says, well, we need to, you know, their solution is to basically wake the masses and cause this big revolution. Okay. Well, don't
snap my click my pointy jaws and kill you all. Like, that's the response. It's right. Not,
yeah. So I think even though Jack has been through who knows how many horrible experiences and has had to deal with whatever atrocities or even taken part in many atrocities himself, it doesn't change the fact that as we learn, as we are gruesomely reminded, he still wears emotional blinders and doesn't see everything through.
And also, he can't imagine the one-up.
Right.
Right? He can imagine so far as to say, well, what would they do? Of course, that's running through his mind as he's going in there and he's hoping for the best that they're just going to say, well, okay, if you say no, that's fine. And he's looking for the war that he's used to, which is, let's battle this out. I'm going to shoot you. You're going to send some bombs. It's going to be great. Mm-hmm. And they go, okay, lockdown. Everyone in this building dies. Right. Bring it.
He's so accustomed at this point to being the immortal savior slash martyr that I don't think he is always aware of what's in his periphery. And he has gotten, especially because of the fact I feel that the moments that they were taking earlier in the episode where Yanto was really staring him down and really starting to, you could see the trust starting to shatter.
But also the let me help you trust. Yanto was still trying to say, let me in.
Right. Well, my point was that because they had that difficult conversation, and then Yanto basically kind of throws some walls up a bit for a while, is something that I think works to Jack's detriment later, because Jack wants him at his side for that showdown, which puts him in the crosshairs, or puts Yanto in the crosshairs.
Which goes back to the point that his daughter, Sally, Sarah, she makes to the agent, saying, why do you think I've been running away from him for so long?
Yeah.
Because if you've pissed him off, there's nothing that you can do to defend yourself, because everyone's collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because when you can't die, you have nothing to lose.
Yeah, and even if you do have something to lose, it still gets lost, and you wall it up and just, you have to, you keep moving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, he's prepared himself that he's going to lose everything he loves over the course of his unnaturally long life. Yeah. So what are you going to throw at him?
Right.
Exactly.
I don't know if that numbs him to it or makes him more willing to accept those moments when they happen, or
I think they hurt just as much, but he knows that he has to get over them to fight the next fight.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I think that what we have seen is that he tries to keep everything superficial and at arm's length. And the fact that Yanto was able to get through that and actually make him care, he recognized, he's like, this is finite. This is something that I cannot take with me. So I have to cherish every moment that I have. And that's what made it hurt all the worse. That's why he was like, I can't lose him.
Right. So, about losing Yanto.
I'm not reliving that. This is what I've been fearing watching over and over.
This is one of the two things that I remember from the series. And I thought it was at the end of the last episode. So I've been alluding to it for like months now.
I honestly thought it happened way earlier because of the Yanto shrine and everything else. So I've been waiting for it in every episode.
Yeah. No, I couldn't remember whether it was day four or day five. But it doesn't change the fact that...
In my world, Yanto's just dead for this whole thing. Let's be real.
Dead man walking. Yeah. Dead man walking.
I honestly didn't remember that this happened as part of this story until you guys were like, there's things I remember happening. There's like one thing specific. I'm like, what are they talking about? And then it like dawned on me. I'm like, oh, crap, that does happen here, doesn't it? Dang.
There's one more thing that I remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the worst thing.
It is the worst thing.
Yeah.
It's the worst thing. But we won't get ahead of ourselves.
No.
But as far as Jack and Yanto's final minutes together, and it does last for a few minutes. This is not a kind of a, you know, say a little quick thing and then shudder and close your eyes. There is a little bit of back and forth. You know, you get this exchange, the promise to remember, the I live 1,000 years. But the thing that I think hurt me the most... It still does. On every time, the however many times I might have seen this series, probably this is probably the third or fourth time seeing it, was the exchange of "I love you, don't." And you can read that two different ways. You can read it as Jack saying, "I don't want to have this conversation. I don't want you to start saying goodbye things to me. Mm-hmm. Don't do that." Or, "Don't love me." And either way, hurts.
I always took it as the don't, because he knows it but doesn't want to admit it, and knowing that it's so close to the end, mm-hmm. it will distract him from what he knows is his future goal, and also the responsibility that he has as the always gonna live through everything person.
I think the fact that it is left so ambiguous is intentional, because you can take it multiple ways. It doesn't necessarily have to mean just one. It can be both. It can be three things. It can be any multitude of them, because I think that the emotions are running so high at that moment that, yeah, it could mean multiple things, and it should, I really do think. It is.
Yeah, which to that point, though, is also, it also means don't keep talking, because that's what he had said a moment before. Mm-hmm. It was save every last second. Don't say anything else.
I said shush.
I said shush. Stop breathing. You killed yourself because you breathed. Do we think that I don't remember his name, who ran for the red suit, survives?
Oh, not Heller. The kooky engineer. Who just loves the whole idea of, ooh, we built a tank and it's all full of poisons. And, ooh, I can't wait to see what they're going to do.
Do we think he lives, or did he get exposed? Did he run faster than whatever virus?
I don't remember. I got the impression that everybody who was in that building had started breathing it in. It didn't matter if he ran down a flight of stairs and got himself into a hazmat suit. It was already in his system. Him kind of slumping
just
forward.
Dying in the hazmat suit now.
Him just kind of slumping forward. And it wasn't a matter of, whoo, I made it. I'm so tired. I got into that suit so fast. Did you see me get in that suit? No, he slumped over dead.
All right. That's because I don't remember either, so I'm asking.
Yeah, I don't remember, and I almost hope he did survive, just because it makes it that much worse.
Right. That he's the one that got
if
out.
If anybody could have survived that, he is like last on the list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He is the cockroach.
La cucaracha.
So that leaves us with one day to go. And obviously we've now pared ourselves down to the essentials. I mean, even if you don't remember exactly what happens in day five, and most of us don't, we at least know that a lot of the periphery has just been burned away at this point. You know, we've with the exposure of everybody getting picked off in that building, That basically just leaves our Torchwood duo and a half, Reese. You know, I forgot Reese. Yeah, all right, our Torchwood trio. We'll go trio.
You're speaking about people who are surviving. Mm-hmm. Why did they sever the connection with
Clem.
They say the remnant, Clem?
I've got some theories about this because, all right, so we know that they went back on the deal. They weren't supposed to come back. They did. But technically, the deal never was completed as promised because they never got 12 kids. And clearly, right. They knew about it. So yep. They were well aware that they only got 11 kids. So are these the kind of creatures that would be like, I mean, it's a technicality. We can go back. I mean, we know that they're skeevy enough that they probably would have come back anyway because they're just evil. But I'm wondering, had Clem actually gone, would they have gone elsewhere? You know, is that something? And you kind of have to go back. And all of the times where Clem's like, they know I'm watching. And, you know, and Gwen's just like, no, that's the camera that's in the room. And then, you know, something else happens. And he's like, they know that I'm here. And it's like, no. It's just that he was right. They did know. They knew the whole time.
We don't know how.
They had a connection with him.
They've got a mental connection with everybody.
But.
Or with all the kids and Clem. But I would think if they were coming back because of a technicality on the deal, they would have said so.
Yeah.
Somebody would have said, like, you promised to never come back. And they would have been like, you promised 12 and only gave us 11.
Yeah.
But the way that they've handled everything else so far is just to keep repeating the what had been said to them, but in a new way, right? So right.
That's their game, is to turn the humanity's words back. That's why they actually mock Frobisher with his own words about the off the record.
They do that, and then he gives them the number, right? And he says, so it's going to be this many, and this many numbers is going to be
6,700 or something like that.
Yeah, and he goes, 6,700. Then what do the children do? They all start repeating numbers from their own country, spelled out like that conversation happened. So, yes, I believe that they would not hold that. They would not say it, just because they're like, well, we know it, but we're not going to tell you.
Yeah.
You did this. It's your own fault, but you don't even need to know why.
Yeah, you save your gambit until it's absolutely necessary.
Right.
But they're full knowledge of what's actually happening at the table, and the ledger is not resolved. So
I don't remember. Did they say in this episode what they use the kids for, or am I remembering that from the next one?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We don't know that yet. Technically.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So they just want kids. They'll stay alive for a long time,
and they feel
and stay young.
Feel no pain.
Feel no pain. Yeah, they look. Yeah, that child looked absolutely pain free, in a poison tank. So there's really not much to say as far as kind of wrapping up on this one, because it is just, we basically are just taking a bunch of blows to the gut, and in full knowledge of the fact that all that's happening when the credits are rolling at the end of this one and starting up on the next one is whoever it is that's been hitting us has just gone to get a sip of water. That's basically all they've done. I have to say the standout for me in this one, again, was Peter Capaldi's work as Frobisher in trying to straddle that weird line of, I don't want to be the villain here, but I'm being put in a villainous position, so I just have to, I have no options, so I'm just, if I have to be the heavy, if I have to be the hard ass, if I have to be the one to say the uncomfortable truths, someone's got to do it, and maybe I'm seen as the better man because I stepped up to actually do it when others wouldn't.
You could see the disgust on his face when those conversations were having, but he did not step up and say, nah.
Right, exactly. He just called his wife and basically said, our kids are safe. That's all.
That was before they had that conversation, though.
This is, Frobisher knows, he has power at that table, or perceives that he has power at that table.
See, I think that's what it is more than anything. More than it's like, oh, it's a terrible decision and someone's got to make the terrible decision and I'm the man to make the hard calls. I think it's more that he's like, this is a terrible situation, but this is a great opportunity for me. And he's going to capitalize on this to advance himself as much as possible.
And try to push the blame back on everyone else and say, like, I can do the logistics, but you got to make the decision.
Yeah, and he hasn't realized that he's being set up as the fall guy.
So that leaves us with one. So when we come back in about 3 weeks, we'll be able to finally put the drive the dagger all the way home. So that'll be fun.
Give it a twist.
I'm not ready for it still.
Well, we've never been ready for it. We just do it. It's just something you're never ready for, so we're just going to do it. Because as we've seen other podcasts starting to do their Torchwood rewatches, they're all looking forward to doing this series too. So
the writing is great. The real life, what could happen makes sense.
Yeah.
And it really makes you think if you want to think about those kinds of things.
It does. Yeah.
I don't want to think about it.
I don't either. I just want to drink a lot more and cry myself to sleep.
There you go.
Same.
Single item for this week's news, because we're still, you know, the news outlets are starting to get into hoopla, who's going to be the next Doctor. We knew this was going to happen. They're just wasting no time, because there's really, you know, as far as on the Whovian front, it's kind of slow news right now, right? That would be the only thing you'd really want to discuss. There is an interesting point of conversation coming around that is not necessarily so much about the casting of the 14th Doctor, so much as it is who has been, as we talked about last week, who do we think has already been given the tap to be the next showrunner, because...
You mean it's not one of us and we're not keeping a secret? Just making sure. Okay.
Right. So Haley's been lying to us. But one of the names that's starting to float around, and this is as a result of unconfirmed rumors and then people saying, well, yeah, I know it's a rumor and all, but sort of suss this one out for a second and see if it has any credence to it, is the name of a showrunner by the name of Sally Wainwright. If you're not familiar necessarily with Wainwright's name right off the top, you might be if there's a very popular show on the BBC right now, Gentleman Jack, that is actually led by Sir Anne Jones, who you will remember who played the Doctor's wife, Idris, the manifestation of the TARDIS back in the 11 Doctors era. She's the lead in the show Gentleman Jack, which is a sci-fi series. Wainwright's also worked on things like Last Tango in Halifax, which is a long-running series, Happy Valley, but has also, at one point, was tapped to be showrunner for what never turned out to be a fourth season of one of Julie's favorite shows, Robin Hood.
Well, you can't, because, spoiler alert, things happened at the end. I won't say it, but...
Right, because the BBC decided that they weren't going to do a fourth season, but they had already... basically extended the hand to her, saying if we decide to greenlight this, we want to give you the helm. Because this was, at the time Robin Hood dropped, it was something that was right within the wheelhouse of that Doctor Who kind of funny, out of present time adventure. It had its suspense, it had its drama, it had its character interactions that made you really care about them, but it still had heart and had humor running throughout. So it had a very Who-esque feel. So
I even love the sheriff.
Right. Yeah, if you can even like the villains, you know. They say that there might be some complications to the credibility of this particular rumor based on her schedule and all the irons that she has in the fire going forward.
But who wouldn't drop everything and say, sure, yes, let me step onto that show over there?
Well, it's like 2 years out for the next season.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's 2 years out. And they have started to set a precedent for how quickly they actually turn the show around. So if you do all of your production blocks and you can sequence them so that it doesn't interfere with other projects that are also probably BBC greenlit things. So Moffat did it all the time, saying, oh, well, I want to work on Sherlock, but then I'm going to switch gears and do everything and I'm going to put myself in Doctor Who mode. And then, I'm going to do a Dracula series for a little while. And he was able to kind of juggle that.
So are we learning that there are a set number of actors from the UK as well as a set number of showrunners from the UK, and they all have to do all these shows before they're allowed to, I don't know, pass into infamous glory or something like that?
To a certain degree, yeah. I guess it's kind of seen as a farm team in a way, but it's also a matter of you're handing the reins over to a commodity that the BBC takes pretty seriously, that they don't want to see teed up for failures.
Oh, you mean like highlighting them for their 100th anniversary and making a big deal out of it?
That kind of thing, yeah.
Cool.
The one of the little interesting caveats to this conversation is the fact that some of the talent that Wainwright has worked with would make interesting taps for the 14th Doctor, like Sir Ann Jones. What if the 14th Doctor looked like the TARDIS? How interesting would that be? Or, and Jay would get a big kick out of this, the fact that that she has also worked with Nicola, or is currently working with Nicola Walker.
There you go.
Livchenka from Big Finish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's done so many great things outside of that right. as well.
Yep.
I honestly had hoped she would have been 13.
Could have worked. Yeah. I think, I don't know whether that name came up when we were doing a lot of our suppositions, but yeah. So yeah, while it may be just a hill of beans, that's fine. But these are the kinds of interesting little thought experiments where you're like, oh, okay,
some tasty beans.
Them some tasty beans. Yeah. And you got to get your legumes. So this is the high quality rumor that we continue to bandy about here in GPR. You don't have to give us facts or anything. Just give us something that we can gnaw on for a little while and say, well, what if? Ooh, wouldn't that be something?
I'd take it.
I will say the first time I saw this, I was like, that would be a great choice. And then looked who posted it. I was like, I think that's just fan casting of the showrunner. So that's where I am putting this nugget that we will chew on until we get a new nugget.
Yeah. YouTubers.
Like, you know, when you get the chicken nugget that's like all grizzle that's been deep fried and you're like, I'm still going to chew on it for a while. That's what we've got right now.
That's why we went vegan.
I'm going to get the flavor out of it, even though I'm getting absolutely no nutritional value.
And now with the taste of thrice fried nugget in our mouth, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up and say that next week we're coming back with our classic rewatch. This time we're going into Time Lash.
Yes. We have to finish the 19th season and figure out exactly how things are in the TARDIS classroom when one of the students is dead. This is just a really happy show.
Right.
Torchwood death, Doctor Who death.
Death all over the place for us lately. Jeez.
I don't know what we can cover next.
This has been episode 437 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, man, I really hate this show sometimes.
This is Gear saying, all right, guys, I've got Reese in the lorry with the laptop. Do I win?
This is Julie saying, I'm just going to be over here crying in the corner. It's going to be fine. What could possibly go wrong?
And this is Haley saying, join us next week for GPR 438. 438.
We'll see you next week.
Allons-y.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Want to keep the conversation going? You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, or just send us a good old-fashioned email to feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also give us a phone call at 754-225-5477. That's 754-CALL-GPR, and you may hear your voice on a future episode of the show. Everything's got to end sometime, otherwise nothing would ever get started. Join us next week for a brand new episode.
Jacob Hansen. Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2021. We'll see you next week.